oftentimes it's better to start with creativity to help you learn the facts.
Life is too short to learn a list of 1,000 rando words.
From the campus of Stanford University, this is Schools In with your hosts, Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope.
Welcome to Schools In. I'm Denise Pope, senior lecturer with the Graduate School of Education here at Stanford, and I'm with my co-host, Dan Schwartz, Dean of the Graduate School of Education. And due to COVID-19 safety measures, we are actually not together in the studio today, but we are at our different homes. And our guest today will also be joining us from his office or home.
Well, Dr. Dislocated Pope. Actually, I'm the one who's dislocated.
I know.
I've been chased out of my home. So we'll see how it goes today. So I would like to present you with a forced choice.
Oh.
You get an A and a B.
Okay. Boy. Okay. Here we go.
So diversifying is important. Race relations are important. Improving inclusion, access, respecting identities. So what role should a university play? And so let me give you two choices. One is you could invest in the diversification of the students and faculty. So you increase representation from groups that normally haven't been in the professorate. Another approach is you could invest in research on the impacts of race in America. So do you choose A or B?
Can I not choose both? I mean, it should be both, Dan, right? I mean, you can't, I would say if you ask me which of those two is more important right now, if you had to do one, I would say A. Because I know that people need to feel community, and you're not going to learn if you don't have community, and we need different ideas represented, you know, ASAP. But so, I also think B is really important too.
Right. So I liked your first answer, which was C.
Usually you get mad when I try to give a separate answer. I thought this was a forced choice.
Stand up to the test, Denise.
Okay.
Don't accept it on its terms.
I say C.
C, it's a false dichotomy.
You
can do both.
Thank you.
And so at Stanford, we're doing both. We're doing something called Impacts of Race in America. And we're bringing in postdoc fellows who will study this. And Matt, our guest today, is actually running this very complicated postdoc fellow program. And we're doing what's called a cluster hire, where we're hiring up to 12 faculty, 6 for the STEM disciplines and 6 for the humanities and social sciences that study the impacts of race in America. And of course, these scholars are very likely to come from the segments of the population that are most impacted by this because it's what they care about. So it's a way to sort of do both.
Nice.
Aren't we clever?
So clever. No, I'm glad it's happening. And it couldn't happen at a better time, right? I mean, it should have happened long ago, and let's like do it and get it done. Sometimes these hires take forever.
I don't think you get it done. You get it going. It's very complicated, where you basically have a search committee at the level of the university.
And just for the audience, that's not how it's usually done, right? There's a search committee at the level of...
Usually the psych department has a search committee for someone in psychology.
Right.
And then they argue, should it be someone in developmental, social, cognitive, you know? But here it's at the university level. So it's a lot of applications. It's a lot of hard decisions, but I'll tell you, it's a lot of great talent showing up. So it's very exciting.
That's so exciting. I'm thrilled.
Well, it's a step in the right direction.
Yeah. So we have Matt on the show.
Yes. Yeah? So I spilled the beans. We have Matt. No. So we're very lucky today to have Matt Snitt. He's a professor of sociology in the School of Humanities and Sciences at Stanford. He's also the vice provost for faculty development. And his area of specialty is on race relations and racial issues in America. He's a demographer. So if anybody has questions about the census, this is the guy. He's also as the vice provost for faculty development, he focuses on recruiting and retaining diverse faculty. So thank you for joining us, Matt.
My pleasure, Dan.
So let me start up with a softball question for you. How did you end up in the role of Vice Provost for Faculty Development, Diversity, and Engagement? So it's a longer title. It's not just faculty development. It's Faculty Development, Diversity, and Engagement. And I want you to begin your story from when you were 5 years old.
I think he's serious, Matt. I actually think he's serious. Like, how did you get from point A all the way to where you are now?
I can give you an abbreviated version, is that I'm a baby boomer. And I grew up watching Walter Cronkite and CBS News and watching Martin Luther King and African Americans, the civil rights movement in the South, being hosed and having dogs turned on them and beaten. And I used to ask my mom, like, what's going on here? What's happening? Why is this happening to these people? And my mom would just say, well, white people want to be treated just like everybody else. And I thought, well, what's wrong with that? And she said, well, a lot of people don't think that's right. And I said, well, why? And she said, well, that's just the way it is. Mm. And, you know, I'm American Indian by background. I'm Oklahoma, Cherokee, and Choctaw. And I sort of grew up seeing lots of different kinds of Indians. And there were some who were doing pretty well, like the Osage in Oklahoma had oil. And then there were some, like the Navajo, who were really poor. And I used to ask my mom again, like, well, you know, why are there so many different types of Indians? She'd just say, that's just the way it was. And then when I finally got to college, I took my first sociology course and found out that that wasn't just the way it was and that it didn't have to be that way. And the whole experience of discovering sociology was a totally liberating experience. I mean, I can't begin to explain, you know, how thrilled I was to find something that really kind of spoke to my interest in the world.
Matt, let me interrupt for just a second. And so did you go back and try and teach your mom that it's not just the way it was? Like, how did that go?
Those were a series of really difficult, painful conversations. Mm-hmm. So not too much family history here.
Okay.
Totally fair. Totally yeah. Fair.
But eventually I found my way to Stanford and then ended up being the director of the Center for Comparative Studies of Race and Ethnicity, which in turn led me to being asked to oversee the Faculty Development Initiative, which is about bringing racial scholars of race and ethnicity to Stanford. And then when my colleague Karen Cook left the Office of Faculty Development and Diversity, the provost asked me if I would step in and take over from her. When Karen Cook stepped down, I stepped in, and here I am.
Well, I'm glad you're there.
So am I.
So CCSRE. So right now, Stanford is in a process of thinking about whether to departmentalize African American studies and other studies that focus on that are very person focused. Kinds of departments. But my understanding is CCSRE originally was sort of a very creative approach to kind of addressing the same issues. Do you know the history of it at all?
Yeah.
Just for our listeners, CCSRE is the Center for Study of Race and Ethnicity, Comparative Race and Ethnicity. Yeah.
I was in college in the early years of ethnic studies, which was was something else that I found completely liberating to discover. And that first generation of ethnic studies, which would be African American studies, which was established here at Stanford in 68, and ethnic studies programs across the country tended to be focused on specific groups. So there's African American studies, Native American studies, Latin American studies, Asian American studies, and on. And what those programs endeavored to do was in a sense to create a curriculum and a body of knowledge that spoke to the interests and concerns of those particular groups. So Native American studies was very focused on law, public policy, on land reservation management. African American studies had a entirely different emphasis and so on. When the Center for Comparative Studies of Race and Ethnicity was created, it represented what amounted to a second generation of ethnic studies, and that second generation was comparative in nature. And so it was sort of the idea that you could take those bodies of knowledge that had grown to that point and then learn comparing across groups, you could draw up what was similar and what was different from the various experiences. And that represented a new body of knowledge, a new understanding of the meaning of race and ethnicity, and mostly here in America, but eventually it has sort of gravitated out into the world. There's a much more international direction that ethnic studies has taken in the last decade. And so that, you know, that the center really was the first of its kind in the country. And there are numerous ethnic studies programs now that are modeled after it. Connecticut College even named its program after it.
This is Schools In with Denise Pope and Dan Schwartz. We are talking with Matt Snipp today, Vice Provost for Faculty Development at Stanford, about a center for comparison of race and ethnicity, which is a bit unusual, starting to be more typical, but we were one of the first. So I have a question for you, Matt. I know that you teach race and ethnic relations in the USA. I'm assuming that's part of that, the comparison that you were just talking about. Tell us about the course. How did you put that together? Was there a need for this? How do you do that?
You know, it's interesting. The course, I've been teaching it now for almost 20 years, and the course has evolved. I spent the last years of the course, you know, during Obama's administration, really trying to persuade students that, in fact, there were lots of problems out there, that we weren't in a post-racial society, and that we couldn't act as if everything was just fixed and fine now.
Would students get upset when you would sort of try and explain to them that one man doesn't make the difference?
A little upset. They would mostly just shut down.
Well, you know, I took a look at your syllabus. That's a lot of readings.
From all different, I mean, that's the other thing, right? How do you choose a reading list to be inclusive when there's so many different issues and so many different things going on in this comparison of race and ethnic studies?
Well, you know, the way I try to teach it, I'm a sociologist, as you mentioned, and race is one of the fundamental organizing principles of the society we live in. And so I sort of pick more or less arbitrary, it's more or less arbitrary, Chris, but I pick a number of different venues or where race is really important and how it shapes the world we live in. So there's race in politics and public policy. There's race in the media. There are all these different venues where race shapes the social experience, the sort of the lived social experience of our everyday lives. And then that's what I try to sort of, that becomes the organizing principle for it.
So how do the students respond when you discuss how race plays out in education?
They're pretty responsive. I mean, it has changed over time, because after Obama stepped down, and it wasn't too long after that, we had Michael Brown murdered in Ferguson.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And then we've had just this sort of string of police killings of black men. And, I was no longer in the business of trying to persuade students that race is no longer a problem. But now we've sort of moved into a different era of how do we think about racial justice, and what are the best ways to bring it about?
This is Schools In with Denise Pope and Dan Schwartz, and we are talking with Matt Snipp, and he is telling us how the course he's been teaching for several years has changed in relation to what's going on in society right now with race relations. What did you do, given that you were teaching this right in the middle of all this happening? What did you do to change or update at that point?
Well, we started talking about more about police practices, mass incarceration. I invited Laura Wilson, the chief of police for Stanford, to come and talk with the students about how she thinks about race. Mm. the other thing is spent more time talking about race and sports. One year I had two football players, African-American football players. And that was really illuminating in terms of how they talked about their lived experience in the locker room as football players. And they had high hopes of going on to play in the NFL. But this was also around the time that Colin Kaepernick was, struggling with the NFL over in taking a knee. And so those were some really interesting conversations.
So those conversations would scare a lot of faculty. How did you manage to keep everything on honest, but on an even keel?
Well, you know, I tried to be as transparent as possible. There was one section in the class where we do race in the media. And basically, we spend a lot of time looking at a lot of really, really nasty, vile, racist material that just about anybody can find if you just scratch the surface of the internet just a little bit. And before we do that, I explained to the students that, you know, look, you know, if you don't want to look, you don't have to. But this is important stuff because you have to look at it and you have to know it's there. You have to know what it looks like and the kind of people that put it out there. Because it's if you're really trying to understand race and racism in American society, if you don't look at that, if you don't know what it is, then it's really like trying to teach medicine without ever having to touch a sick person.
Mm-hmm. Good analogy.
But also totally brave. I mean, there have been people who've been fired from universities for basically doing that, Matt. So did you ask for permission from someone? Were you worried? Did that cross your mind at all?
Well, don't ask a question if you don't want to hear the answer.
Got it.
You know, I've used the N-word in class, but again, I've explained why I've used it. And I think the students have understood, and you know, it's a careful thing you have to do, but I think the students understand if they know where you're coming from and they trust you. You know, if they really trust you, then they feel like they can give you some latitude.
Hmm. This is Schools In with Denise Pope and Dan Schwartz. We will have more with Matt Snipp talking about race and ethnic relations in the USA and particularly teaching a course on that topic next on SiriusXM.
You're listening to Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope.
So it is hard to predict what the future will be.
The focus is really on academics.
From the campus of Stanford University.
Welcome back to Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. We are talking with Matt Snipp, who teaches race and ethnic relations in the USA as part of his job. He's also vice provost for faculty development and diversity at Stanford. And we're having some fascinating conversations about teaching some very controversial topics.
So Matt, as part of trying to help the faculty have difficult conversations, there was an approach which was to give the faculty the description of a scenario. Right. And then they would discuss how would they handle that? How would they prevent it? And this scenario was like the worst scenario ever. It was a student says something, another student says something that offends, that is a backlash to the first student. The professor steps in and says something. The first student starts to cry and then leaves the room. And then the faculty are left, you know, what do you do about this?
That's a nightmare.
This one was very difficult. But so has that ever happened to you when, you know, not that specific instance, but some meltdown that really was tough?
Not really, not in this particular class. But, you know, I also teach a class about inequality, and we got to talking about gender inequality in one session. It was a seminar. And I actually had a student break down because she got to thinking about her mom, and her mom was a Asian immigrant who apparently was abused by her dad.
Yeah.
And that got to be a tough situation. We just took a little break and me and the students sat down and had kind of a heart to heart.
Oh, that's nice. That's a good approach. So how about the race relations course? Is there, that's a volatile possibility.
It is. But the way I've always approached that from the very second time that I ever taught this was that the very first day in the syllabus, there's a set of ground rules. And I basically, you know, take a few minutes the very first day in class and just say, you know, have a look at these. And we're not going to spend a lot of time talking about them, but I want you to look at them. And I want you to take them to heart. And so when you get back to your room tonight, look at them a little more closely and think about them. And there are things like, you know, don't pile on. If somebody, you know, if somebody criticizes somebody else and you don't have something different to add to that, then you don't need to, you know, people don't need to be told that they're stupid twice. Once is usually enough.
Denise, did you hear that?
Oh my gosh, Dan, ground rules. Come on.
Sorry.
Continue, Matt. Continue. This is good.
They, you know, we, you know, ask people to, you know, pay attention to their body language, that a smirk can be as hurtful as an actual insult. And that, you know, and then if people find that they are becoming sort of angry to the point that they can't really deal, then they're welcome to get up and take a walk outside the class and think about it. One that I had to add after this initial list was for people not to use, you know, something their Uncle Harry said or did as evidence or proof of something, a fact, because there's no way to dispute that fact without disputing Uncle Harry or mom or their dad.
That's a really important one. I think these things are so personal that people come in with these stories and they want to treat them as if that is representative of everything everywhere.
And so, you know, so there's, like I said, there's probably, I think, 11 or 12 of these ground rules that I've got.
Egregious violation of ground rules means you might not pass the class.
Yeah.
Or you won't pass.
You will not.
You will not pass. Yeah. I think you're one of the bravest professors at Stanford, or maybe even in the U.S. right now, Matt. So thank you for those.
If we think about departmentalizing African-American studies, Indian studies, gender studies, a common response is, well, you'll end up with too many. There's just too many categories that you might have, right? You wouldn't do Asian studies, that's too coarse, right? You need to do Chinese studies and Japanese studies. So I don't know how to think about that. And given that you know about the census, I was hoping there was some wisdom, at least in the process by which they decide the categories to include.
Well, I wish I could tell you that it was this sort of very carefully considered set of categories that is rooted in science and well-founded in scholarship, and there's nothing of the sort.
Oh, that's such a disappointment to hear. I cannot tell you.
Well, it's actually rooted in the Constitution of the U.S. Mm-hmm. And the Constitution in Article 1, Section 2 basically says that there shall be a count of all free persons, excluding Indians not taxed, and 3/5 of all other persons who are African-American slaves. And so that was the first racial classification of the United States was right there. It evolved over time. There were categories that have been added. There have been categories that have been deleted. And the kind of the most recent set sort of have their origins in something called the Office of Management and Budget Directive Number 15, revised October 1997. And it's really rooted in the federal government's need to monitor violations of civil rights, and so it basically, you know, it kind of going back in sort of the history that predates this, which is in early 1970s, is that the government had all of these different laws, civil rights laws, that they were expected to monitor. And they had a hodgepodge of different categories, and so they formed an interagency working group, and they decided, you know, which are the groups that are subject to protections by the civil rights laws and civil rights legislation, and they came up with a list, and it was African Americans, it was Native Americans, whites, and then Asian Pacific Islanders. And that was the basic set of categories they came up with.
This is Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. We are speaking with Matt Snipp, an expert on race relations, ethnic relations, talking to us about the census categories and how they decide on those categories. I don't know if that answered your question, Dan, but how would you then take that and apply it to what you just asked Matt about? You know, what do you do in terms of departments?
That wasn't so helpful. I mean, it was... it sounds like people six or seven people in a room and someone says, well, we ought to include this. And everybody else goes, sure. Okay. It doesn't sound quite, maybe it's more deliberative than that. I don't know.
It was more deliberative. It was a 28 person committee and they met almost 3 years.
Oh, wow.
Oh my gosh. And that led to the latest rendition.
It led to the first standard classification. And like I said, they met from 74 to 77. They issued the first set of categories in 77. In the early 90s, after the 1990 census, they received so many complaints from so many different groups that they revisited it. One of the things they did was that they split off Native Hawaiians from Asian and Pacific Islanders and created just an Asian category, and then a Native Hawaiian other Pacific Islander category. And
wow.
So they added, they added Hispanics, and in 77 they added Hispanics, but they said Hispanics could be of any race, and so they came to be known as an ethnic group, which, you know, if you know anything about race and ethnicity, it starts to look a little silly.
Well, wait, that actually brings up a question that I have heard, which is, what is the difference between race and ethnicity?
My take is no difference at all. It's just a way of othering people.
Mm. Fascinating. Dan? So,
and you have to know the history of those two ideas to really understand why they're not really different at all.
So that means we could get rid of one of them?
Yeah.
Which would you like to get rid of? Both? Neither?
I toss a coin.
Yeah.
Wow. That's crazy. So the census that's making all these distinctions is really flawed, in your opinion.
The census is a political instrument, and it's a reflection of political interests and political ambitions. In the 1930 census, there were Hispanics, or there were Mexicans in the 1930 census. There was a Mexican race. They disappeared in 1940 because the Mexican government objected.
Mm.
And Mexicans at that time wanted to be considered as white people.
Thank you, Matt. It's been a fascinating show. And thank all of you for listening to Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. If you missed any of this episode, listen anytime on demand with the SiriusXM app and anywhere you listen to podcasts.
From the campus of Stanford University, this has been Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope on SiriusXM Business Radio. If you missed any of it, listen on demand, online, or with the SiriusXM app.